I believe we have all preliminaries and commercials out of the way. Last night in Carmichael, I was very privileged to have a preview of our distinguished speaker for tonight. So I approached Father and I said, Father, I said, do you have any special way you would like to be introduced? Well, I was so impressed with his talk, I decided to make it as simple as possible. I sure don't want to take any of his time away from him, and I'm sure you would a lot rather hear from him than you would from me. So without any further delay, I'm going to introduce to you Father B. of Portland, Oregon.
Thanks, Ricky, for that very kind and short introduction. I hope that I can do as good a job on the talk as you did on the introduction. I'm not saying this just to be polite, but I'm very happy to be here tonight. Just as I'm happy to be with alcoholics and Al-Anons at any time. They're the greatest people in the world. You know, I travel around various places. And you know, you can make either acquaintances or friends as you go around meeting various people. When I go into an AA group such as this, I don't make acquaintances, I make friends. There's a big difference. And that's why I'm happy to be here. I'm especially happy to be in this particular group tonight because it was kind of slow coming. My getting here was something like the disease of alcoholism. It was progressive. And like the program of AA, it took place by the progressive action of some good AAs who you might say were my sponsors for this particular meeting tonight. I think it was back in September of 1963, I got a letter from Cliff and inviting me to come down here to give just this talk, but this a year ago. Well, I was willing. He carried the message. I was willing, but my schedule wasn't. Couldn't make it, so I wrote back, expressed my regrets, but I always left the door open. I said, try me next year. So he did. He sent the message again. And this time I was able to accept. So I wrote back a letter that was coming. And lo and behold, I get another letter back from him saying, well, that's wonderful. But I got another sponsor for you because I'm out of office. I'm turning you over now to Ricky. He's the delegate. So I got my second sponsor. So I get a nice letter from Ricky expressing his great joy that I was coming, but he says, you know, just as Cliff was out of office, he says, I'm a little bit out of proportion here in respect to where this thing is going to be held. I'm a little bit far off. I'm up in Northern California, and it's going to be a little inconvenient to handle the details. So I'm turning you over to Frosty. So I get my third sponsor, Frosty, and I'm not even here yet. And then the fourth sponsor comes up. Pat over there, good old Pat, he sends me the check. He says, here it is, we'll be seeing you. By the way, you know, he's a very trusting soul, Pat. You know, he came out a little while ago and he said, you know what we're going to do tonight, Father? He said, I'm going to wait till after you talk before I take up the collection. Boy, he's a trusting soul. You know, when I go out giving these talks, I can approach it from one of two ways. I can say to myself, well, what do they want to hear tonight? What do they want to hear? Or I can say to myself, what should they hear? And that's the way I'm going to approach it tonight. What should you hear? What should I hear? I'm not standing up here to be a popular speaker. I never intended to be a popular speaker, and I hope I never become a popular speaker. I want to be an honest one. You know, when I get up in the pulpit to preach as a priest, I try not to preach. I don't like preaching. I try to instruct. I try to console. I try to encourage. But I do speak to a congregation. That's my job. When I stand up here at this podium, I will certainly make every effort not to preach, and I'm going to be speaking, first of all, to Father Barney, the alcoholic. And if you want to listen in and get something out of it, go ahead. But I'm going to be speaking to myself first. I have chosen for my subject tonight the 11th step. Last night we were at a meeting in which we talked on the third step. And we really talked. That was one of the finest meetings I've ever attended. I've got some wonderful ideas. You know, I get most of my ideas from you people. I capitalize on them. I sit around and listen. You know, I learned very early in AA to be a good listener. Listen. So tonight we're going to talk on the 11th step. We sought through prayer and meditation. We sought. To me, that means personal effort. It means a need, a thirst. That's why we seek. In other words, my idea of seeking is I seek for something I want, something I need, something I thirst for, just like you used to seek that bottle because you thirsted for it. And boy, you used to seek, didn't you? You used to seek. I was giving a talk not long ago to a group of good Presbyterian ladies in the basement of a Presbyterian church with a Presbyterian minister sitting down listening to what I had to say. So after I got through speaking my piece, I threw it open to questions to these good ladies. And I thought, well, I wonder what they're going to be talking about now, these good ladies. I wonder if they're going to have any questions. I wonder if they understand. Prayer. He goes to an AA meeting and they start out with the serenity prayer. They don't start out with the serenity meditation, but they start out with the serenity prayer and they end with the Lord's Prayer. So he associates prayer with vocal prayer. He says a prayer, the Lord's Prayer, the serenity prayer. I pronounce the words. But then they bring the word meditation. Meditation. I think for many people, you get the idea of meditation, you think of the monks in the desert. Their cowls walking around meditating. And here I get a guy off the program, on the program, off the booze, and I say, here, start meditating. You mean like one of those monks? I used to drink that Christian Brother wine, but I don't know whether I can meditate with him. See? So the poor elk, he's confused. He's confused enough as it is, but you're going to make a monk out of him. He says, what gives? What is this business? Well, it is a little confusing, isn't it? Meditation comes from the Latin word meditare, which means to think about. When you good ladies are baking a cake, I'm not talking about these things you get out of the thing and you throw in the oven. You take off the tinfoil, you throw it in. I'm talking about the one you make. You know, you get your mix master out and you get all these ingredients and you got to weigh this and that and this. You're meditating. You're trying to figure out how am I going to make this thing come out even. So that not every one of them becomes an upside down cake. See? You're meditating. Or you go out and you're going to make something in your workshop. Your preoccupation. You're going to go down there and start working. You're going to make something. You have to meditate on what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. You're meditating. But you're not meditating in the light of the 11th step. The meditation we're talking about here is prayerful meditation. Prayerful. The simplest way I can explain it is by TV. Meditation compared to TV. When you meditate, you use your mind, that is your memory, your imagination, and you use your will. All the faculties of your soul and body you use. All right. Now, what do you do when you watch TV? The first thing you do, you look up to find out what kind of a program you want to look at. If there are any that you want to look at. There are very few that I do. I don't mind seeing a football game once in a while, one of these things, but you get a subject. Now, when I meditate, I got to get a subject. I got to get something to think about. Now, we're going to practice tonight. We're going to meditate together on the 11th step. So I'm not going to give you a talk. I'm giving you a meditation. See, I'm in the retreat business. I don't give sermons when I give a retreat. You get those on Sunday. I don't give you lectures. You get those in a classroom. I give you meditations as a retreat master. So that's what I'm going to do here. We're going to meditate. Now, so the first thing we're going to do, we're going to meditate on the 11th step. Now, if I'm going to meditate in this spiritual TV, I got to turn it on. Okay, I turn it on. I think about the 11th step. I think of the words. We sought through prayer and meditation. I see that. I see those words. What does that mean, to seek through prayer and meditation? You see, I see that on the screen of my imagination. Then my mind examines it. Then I say to myself, do I meditate? Do I know what meditation is? Am I really making this 11th step? I'm supposed to, just as much as I make the first, second, third, or fourth. I can't get up to the 11th and say, well, I'll skip this one. No, I got to make it. Okay. We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact. To me, the word to improve implies a previous contact. I already have it, but now I improve it. Now, where do I get this contact? You remember, I'm at the 11th step. Where did I get this previous contact? In the first 10 steps. It's presupposed. So when I get to the 11th step, I must have some contact with this higher power. Do you see how logical these steps are? Just as logical as steps in a stairway. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and up. Now I'm up to the 11th. I'm going to go back to the first. I'm going back to the first. I'm Father Barney the alcoholic. I had to make the first step. And brother, for me, it was the biggest. I don't think these steps are all just 12 inches high, or 6 inches, or 8 inches. I think they vary considerably with the person. Mine was a wall. It wasn't a step. It was a wall. We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol. We admitted that. We accepted that fact. We honestly believe that. But did we? I didn't. I didn't think I was powerless over alcohol. I used to teach chemistry, in which alcohol was one of my basic subjects. I thought I was on my way to get a PhD in organic chemistry. And the alcohols are the base building blocks of organic chemistry. I thought I knew all the angles. I knew all the chemical formulas. I knew the structure of it. And above all, I figured I knew how to handle it. When I first started drinking, I started drinking apostolically, believe it or not. I think, like any alkie, I had drive. I had compassion with other people. I had ambitions. I was a perfectionist. All those things which go to make up a nalky, I was. And I drove myself too hard. I was advised, you better slow up. But I wasn't going to slow up. I had more things to do.
I had to stretch my day a little. I know that eating and sleeping were important things, but sometimes you don't have time to eat and to sleep if you're going to do your job, so you don't do it. But you have to keep going. So like every alky, I found something in alcohol that gave me a lift or a surcease that I couldn't get anywhere else, and I had to have it fast because I had to keep working. I couldn't be going on a vacation. I couldn't do this. I had to do it and do it fast and keep going. And all the time I had to keep my priestly responsibilities, I had to be sure that I gave no scandal. You see, I had high ideals. The last thing in God's world I wanted to do was give scandal to anyone. So then I began to develop my alcoholic ingenuity, which is considerable. I never knew I had so much. I had it all figured out, even to distances. The odoriferous qualities of alcohol. How far could this brand be smelled? The different ones. I ate so many Clorets that when I put out my tongue to talk, they thought I was St. Patrick. All I had to do was park in a big chair that I had there, a great big leather chair, which was my instant sobering up chair. All I had to do was get a complete relaxation, and I was made. 5 minutes, and I was up like a fighter, shaking my head, putting water in my head. Let's go. What's next? And I'd be off for the next job. And I used to say to myself, what am I getting out of this? I wouldn't dare let myself go. I wouldn't dare let myself feel jovial. No. I'd fight all the effects. And I said, what a stupid thing to do. Why am I doing it? Well, I didn't have time to answer that question. In this particular town where I was the pastor of the parish. All the drunks in town used to come to me. And I could never figure that out. And I seemed to be able to solve their problems. I could tell when they were phony, and I would tell them they were phony, and I would lecture them, and then to get rid of them, I'd send them to AA. I sent more drunks, alkies, to AA than anybody that had ever been in that region. I built AA up to a tremendous potential. In fact, they'd come back in their gratitude and say, Father, thank you. I'd had saved fellas their jobs, their wives, and they'd come back and, oh, Father, they'd tell me what a tremendous thing. And I could see they were. I could see the change. And I used to wonder about it. And then they'd say... I didn't wonder very much. And then they say, Father, would you come up and give us a little spiritual talk? And I said, me, I'd give scandal if I went up there. Give scandal. I didn't want any part of it. Just get rid of it. But I used to ask myself in my quieter moments, my sober moments, why the heck do you know so much about this? How come you can help them so effectively? And I used to wonder about that. I'd never read any books on it. And then I used to compare them as they came back with myself. They were getting better, and I was getting worse. I'd get some poor guy that was all tied up in knots and had to get a lot of stuff off his chest. That was his fifth step, I guess. I hadn't even heard of the fifth step in those days. So I figured, well, we'll drink a couple of belts together, and he'll loosen up. And he would. He did fine. I cleaned him up good. And he'd be on his way, happy as a lark, and there I was sitting. See? Well, it got so bad that I got panicky about the whole thing. And I knew that I felt an impending doom. I think you've all felt this. There was an impending doom. I knew that one of these days that roof was going to fall in. I didn't know when or where or why, but it was going to fall. And the fact that I didn't know made it worse. Every day I'd get up and I'd wonder, how's this day going to end? And that bothered me. As I say, I fought the emotional effects of this thing, the mental effects, but it was getting me physically. Occasionally I'd go up to the hospital and I had my doctor conned. I'd tell him that I had pains in my chest and a few other things, and I'd go up for 3-4 days and dry out. And then I'd say to myself, now I got to go back and start all over. And it didn't make sense. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to stop. I would stop. I knew what theological drunkenness was. I was a moral theologian. I knew how far I could go, and I never would go that far. And that added to my capacity. So you see, I was in a regular squirrel cage. I was helping everybody else in town, but I couldn't help myself, and I was getting worse. And you know, one of the things that bothered me was this, that if I go, what's going to happen to these poor guys? That is one thing I remember. What's going to happen to them? But it got so that I said, the heck with them. I'm getting out of here. And with the help of my superiors, I got out before I got thrown out. Well, then they sent me into this retreat business. You probably have gathered from now, I've got a kind of akin to talking. I don't mind talking. Give me a subject and give me an audience and let me turn me on. To have somebody turn me off, I feel happy. And I went pretty good for a while. But then the old thing started up again. And I remember one time I was giving a retreat, group of fellas, and as I say, I had, by that time, I was an habitual, taking a little all the time. But here again, plain cat and mouse, the fellow would come in to talk to him, and I'd turn sideways. I got to be an expert to be able to articulate out the side of my mouth. Some of these guys thought I was a ventriloquist. I was never looking at them, but they were getting the message. See? You can learn that, you know. I did. I had to. And I remember one day a fellow came in, a young fellow, nice-looking fellow, and he'd been watching me. This was the second day of the retreat. So when he came in and sat down, I gave him the old pitch. Well, what can I do for you today? What's your problem? You know what he said to me? He said, Father, I didn't come in here to talk about my problem. I came in to talk about yours. And then he proceeded to let me have it, which was the thing I had been waiting for all the time. He turned out to be my sponsor. God bless him. I buried him 3 years ago, but I'll never forget him till the day I die. He saved my life, and he was a sponsor that spoke right straight from the shoulder, and when he hit you, you were clipped, and I thank God for that, because I was quite a scrambler. I was hard to hit, but he hit me, and that was it. And then he said, now, Father, I'll help you under one condition, that you let me, he was a Catholic boy, he said, you let me treat you as a drunk and not as a priest. I said, what do you mean by that? I was getting it straight. He said, just what I mean. He said, if I would look upon you just as a priest, I wouldn't have guts enough to tell you some of the things you're going to have to hear. I said, I see the point. So he said, now, to make this very clear, before we start, he says, I'm going to ask you if I may be permitted to do something, to re-baptize you. And I said, what's the matter? Is this guy drunk? He said, Father, he says, we're going to have to change your name. Because I'm going to bring you into an organization that's anonymous, and your name isn't going to be anything but Barney. From now on, you're going to be Barney. That's how I got my name. Barney. He says, we're going to have to go down to a group. He says, I'll show it to you tonight. But he says, we're going to have to go down incognito. You can't go down with this on. I wasn't about to go down with this on. I could have told him that before he even mentioned it. So I'll never forget. We went down to the big department store and got Father Barney his slacks. I've used them since for golf. A nice sport shirt, Barney's. And then he says, now tonight we make our maiden voyage. I said, to where? I thought he might say, well, we'll go down to the Montnoma Hotel. I'd heard they had a professional group down there with the doctors and lawyers. And I was a professional person. He said, no, we don't go to the Montnoma Hotel. We go down to Gleason Street on Skid Row. I said, you kidding? He said, no, I never was so serious in my life. He says, for two reasons. First of all, I want to show you where you can end if you keep drinking. And I'll show you characters down there that are there that were in very high positions. Secondly, I want you to go down there to save your anonymity because you're not going to run into any of your friends down there. You won't meet the bishop down there. That's what he was saying. And I didn't want to see the bishop. So I said, let's go. I'll never forget. Have you ever, any of you been to Gleason Street in Portland? Yeah. That's my home group. Well, I walked in there. I remember the first night I walked in, and I cased the joint before I ever went in. I had to go look through the window. You remember the little windows there to see who was in there and who wasn't. Well, I had never recognized any of those characters, so I walked in. And I sat down, and I was completely confused, befuddled, but I wanted some help. So I sat down. And I know that, remember, they started the meeting, they started reading the fifth chapter and the steps and the traditions, and I wasn't even listening to them. There was only one thing that got my attention. On the wall, there was a sign which said, think. Think. And I said, what a thing to put on the wall. Why do they put that up there for? Why should we have to be reminded to think? And then it dawned on me. I meditated on think. That made lots of sense. I hadn't been thinking. And I hadn't been thinking straight. And I knew that if I were going to save my life, I would have to start thinking fast and tough. Or I was going to die, and I knew it. I knew that one word would save me if I could just hang on and think. So I would keep fighting the cobwebs. I had alcoholic fog, but I would keep fighting. I was like a boxer who was clipped. And I knew that I had to keep fighting or I was dead. And I fought because I didn't want to die. And I didn't want to go crazy. And I knew that if I kept drinking, I would go crazy. I knew that. So I fought. But in fighting, I felt so alone. Sure, I had my sponsor with me. But who was going to walk in and spot me and then report me to the bishop? And there I was. That was always my fear. Every time somebody would walk in the door, I was like, who's that? See? Well, this went on for a few weeks. You know, this anonymity will kill you. I think it destroys or keeps more people off this program than anything I know, the fear of anonymity. I have always said this, and I say it again, if there is one person in the world toward whom you are afraid to manifest your problem, you're dead. Because if you ever get in the presence of that person, you're offered a drink, you'll drink to save your anonymity. I've seen it happen. And I didn't want that to happen. I knew that if I were going to do this, I had to be honest. I had to let people know. And above all, I had to let my archbishop know. So I told my sponsor, I said, Jim, this is the hour of decision. We made one big one. Now we got to make a bigger one. I can't hack this anymore until I go and tell the bishop. Now, he may tell me to go to Siberia, but I got to take that chance. So I... And what made it worse, the Archbishop thought I was a great guy. I had done some business with him. I had taught in his school, and I'd given some retreats for him, and he thought I was a great guy, and I was going to down tell him what kind of a guy I was. And he was an old man. I thought he might get a heart attack. So I went down. I knew I had to. I had no choice. Just as I had to quit drinking, I had to make this a decision. I had to do it, come what may. So I went down. I told him my story. Started right from the beginning. And as I went along, I became very surprised. He hadn't once interrupted me. And he was listening with the deepest of interest. And as I went along, I noticed that his eyes started to mist up. And as I went farther and farther, tears started to form. And they started to come down his cheeks. And he made no effort to hide them. And when I got through, he stood up and he said, "Father, kneel down. I'll give you my Episcopal blessing. I admire you for what you've told me. I feel that from now on you will be a great apostle for these poor people that have the same problem you have. God bless you," and ever since he's been my biggest booster. You see? Well, I walked out of there. That was one of the greatest spiritual awakenings I ever had in my life. Why didn't I trust God? Why was I fearful? And whenever I get fearful now, I remember the day I sat before the Archbishop and told him my story. And I thank God for that Archbishop. In the third step, we committed ourselves to the journey of sobriety, serenity, and sanctity. We commit ourselves to the journey. In the first step, we come down to the roadblock of the aversion of nature. Nature can't take any more. My mind, my stomach, my liver, everything is revolting. I can't take any more. I heard a fellow describe alcoholic convulsions the other night. They're fantastic. And when he got through, I said, "Thank God I never had an alcoholic convulsion." Then I said, "I did have. Every one of us have had it. Anyone who has experienced the first step, really experienced it, has had a convulsion of nature, an aversion for this step. You want to turn your back away from it. That's what you mean, to turn around, away from it. You want to get away from this thing that's killing you, that's destroying you, that you can't live with and you can't live without. You got to get rid of it. You do. And then in the second step, you come to the conversion of grace. We came to believe in a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. See, to me, this is a critical step. I've seen fellows make the first step and go right on over into the abyss of despair. See, it's not enough to turn from. You've got to turn to. You've got to turn to God, your higher power. Then in the third step, we go into partnership with God. He's going to walk this path of sobriety, serenity, and sanctity right to the very end with us, if we let him. If we walk step by step with him, that's moment living, day by day with God. I have a heartbeat contract with God. As long as this old heart's beating, I'm in business. When it stops, I'm out of business. I'm a heart patient, too. It just about stopped 8 years ago this month. So I became very, very aware of that fact, that I'm in a heartbeat contract with God. That's a good way to be. Because you have to stay close to him. In step with him. Not ahead of him, not behind him, but right with him. And that's what this program teaches us to do. Sought to improve our conscious contact with God. You know, there are two kinds of prayer. There's the spontaneous inner prayer, For instance, when something real good happens, you say, oh, thank God. And, I mean, you didn't intend to say it, but it comes out, oh, thank God that this didn't happen. Oh, thank God he's on the program. Oh, thank God he isn't drinking. Or you get in a tight spot and you say, oh, God, help me. It comes out spontaneously. Gee, that's a beautiful prayer. That comes from your inner self. That's your better you. But you know, unfortunately, those things don't happen too often for most of us. We're more accustomed to the other type of prayer, which is conscious practice prayer. You know, we have this thirst that I talk about. We have all have this thirst for God. As St. Augustine says, our hearts were made for thee, O God, and they do not rest until they rest in thee. I think a Nalky's a little more attuned to the eternal than the average person. God bless you, Al-Anon. But I think that's the way we are. We're a little more attuned to the eternal. We can get a little more bored with the temporal, I think, than the average person. And I think that's one of the reasons we fall victim to this effect of alcohol. It seems to give us a little of the mystical, of the spiritual that we are looking for. So, even though we have this within us, even though inside I feel like that I must pray, on the outside I say I don't want to pray. Human nature says I don't want to pray. I don't have time to pray. See, I drag my feet. So if I'm going to have to pray, if I'm going to have contact with God, it's going to have to be practice, conscious contact. Just like if you're going to make this program, you're not going to get it through osmosis. You're not going to get it by rubbing off from somebody else. You're going to have to work the principles. You work this program. You don't assimilate it. You work it. You digest it. And it's the same thing with prayer. How do I go about becoming an expert in prayer? In meditation, and that's what I have to do. I have to practice. If I want to be a golfer, I happen to be a golfer, one of these hackers that are playing for my heart's condition, not for my score. I go out to keep myself in shape. And boy, do I practice tolerance. I don't know where I practice the principles of AA better than in golf. Because by nature, I'm a perfectionist. I'm a winner. And when I play golf, I'm the worst type of a dub. It hurts my pride, but I hope it's helping my heart. It's been working for 8 years. And I hope it's helping my soul, too. The first thing I have to practice to become an expert in prayer is recollection. Recollection. I got to use this. Think. When I pray, I think. You know, prayer is essentially an act of my inner self. We talk about outer space. I like to talk about inner space. When I'm in meditation, I'm in inner space. When an alcoholic takes a drink, one drink will launch him into outer space. We talk about the astronauts. I think the Alkies were the first of the astronauts. You know, you read from Cape Kennedy the number of flubouts they have down there. These things fizzle out and it didn't work. I've never seen an Elky yet that didn't get off the pad. I know some can get off on the first effort. I know some that are still in orbit and I'm waiting for them to come down. Re-entry. They hate re-entry. I guess they don't like that heat that's generated. But they got to come back, so we're waiting. You know, the world as a whole is out in outer space. How many people actually can sit down for 5 minutes with themselves and to examine themselves and say, who's this guy? Who, what, and why? What am I doing about things? How many people actually do that? Scares them. No, they don't want to get too inquisitive about in this the guy in here. They know all about out there. They know all about you and you and you. How about me? Well, we'll skip that. That's why it's so much easier to take the other guy's inventory. That's easy. But taking a good, fearless, honest inventory of yourself, ha, that takes some doing. I must be recollected, which requires, first of all, concentration. I got to be able to think. I have to do that to do anything well. I was talking about golf. If you can't concentrate, you might as well quit golf. I know I've tried that, some of these lessons, these Arnold Palmer lessons, you know, that you get out of these books, try to improve myself. And I get it all worked out. And I go out there and I think of what I'm supposed to do, how to hold my arm. But you know what? I'd forget about the ball. I was so concentrating on this guy, I forgot to hit the ball. See? That's like an alkie, you know, that comes on the program and he gets so obsessed with something else, he forgets that he shouldn't take that first drink. He's got all the reasons why he drank. He had this mother complex, or he was rejected when he was a kid. He got it all figured out. Maybe some psychiatrist figured it out for him. He had all these things figured out, and he remembers everything except one thing. Don't take the first drink. There he goes, in orbit. See? Think. And think straight. Think realistically. I think one of our problems, not only Alki's problems, anybody's problems, it's very difficult to face the real. There's always that kid about us that we feel much more comfortable in the make-believe. If it would only be this. I know one fellow now who's drinking. And you know why he's drinking? So he has an excuse to say, well, if I weren't drinking, I would be a success in this and this and this. But I'm drinking, therefore I'm not a success. And he's using his booze as an excuse. So he's afraid to come out and face the fact, to make a few mistakes. And maybe he would be a success. So when I meditate, first of all, I've got to become realistic. Get out of the dream world. See things as they are. Not only must I concentrate, but I must be present. I think another problem of Alki's is that we are escape artists. I like to look upon an Alki as a scrambler. Oh, I like to watch pro football. You know, you have the quarterback that stays in the pocket with all those big beefs around him, 265 pounds. I don't know why they don't all do it. And let them take the jolts and you stand there and throw it over the fence. And you're just as dry and clean when the game's over as you never played. But some of these stoops run out of the pocket and scramble, and all these big guys coming to annihilate them. That's the Alki. He loves to scramble. Get out of there. Grab the jug and get moving. As long as you got that jug, you can scramble. See? Now, when we get on the program, that scrambling instinct is still there. So you got to say, listen, brother, be present. Stop. Look and listen. You're going to meditate. For the next 5 minutes, you're going to stay here and meditate. Come what may. You got to do that. You got to anchor your feet. You got to get a time when that's possible, but you've got to stay put and try. This recollection makes us present. It also makes us aware. I think one of our basic problems also is our lack of awareness. We're the last to see and the first to forget. It's fantastic how we can forget. I know fellas now that are scrambling around off the program after 15 years on the program. There's one guy scrambling now. It looks like he's going to scramble to his grave or the nut house. How he could forget and resume drinking It's almost impossible, except that the fact that I, as an alcoholic, know that it is possible. He quit going to meetings. He had it made. He became one of the senior citizens, senior senators, and he never showed up for meetings. And now he's in serious trouble because he forgot. When I stand in meditation, I am aware of the greatest of all realities, God Himself. God Himself is the greatest of the realities. I am also aware of my own reality. I am also now become aware of the reality of other people. You know, there are some people who are so egocentric that there is no reality except in themselves. They don't have a reality for other people. It's only my rights, my privileges, not theirs. When I start meditating, I start losing this realization. I start realizing that there are others than myself. When I stand before God, I must try to visualize Him. God as we understood Him. Now, your understanding of God may be entirely different from mine, but you've got to have some understanding of it. Whatever it is, I respect it, but you should have it. You've got to be able to visualize Him. Now, is it enough for me to visualize God as just a power greater than myself? I think in the beginning that's about all a poor alcoholic can do, maybe, sometimes. He's so confused. Probably the only thing that impresses him at that time is power, because he's so weak that he needs power, a power greater than himself. But I've got to go from power to person. I can't love a power, but I can love a person. And I've got to be able to visualize this higher power as a personal God. Now, what that is, as I say, depends upon your religious training, if you had any, or your own prayer. I think the Lord gave us a pretty good picture of God when He gave us the Lord's Prayer. Our Father. He's a Father. I can love a Father. I can understand a Father. I can understand being a son. But I've got to have some picture. I remember in that Gleason Street meeting that I attended, I remember one night an old fella got up, Skid Row bum, and he got up and he said, you know, when I came on the program, I had to look up the definition of God in the dictionary. I had no formal training at all, and I looked up the definition of God, and then he proceeded to give one of the most beautiful spiritual talks I've ever heard. I said, holy smoke, this must be some program that can develop a person to that extent that he had to start out with a definition of God in the dictionary and come up with that. But that's what he did. After I visualize God, then the next step is that I must enter into a dialogue with God. Not a monologue, a dialogue. I don't just stand there and listen, or I don't stand there and talk. I talk and listen. It's got to be two ways, person to person. You follow me? Here I am now before God. I am a person. He's a person. Okay, what am I going to do? Let's start talking. Let's get acquainted, maybe. I've had fellows on AA say, well, I don't believe in God, Father. I'm an atheist. I says, well, that doesn't keep you off AA because you're an atheist. Or you're an agnostic. I said to him, I said, what do you want to be, a drunken atheist or a sober atheist? It's the only thing I'm interested in now is your sobriety. If you want to be an atheist, go ahead, but be a sober one. Because if you're a drunk one, you're no good anyway. And then I would talk with these fellows, and I'd find out it wasn't a question that they didn't believe in God. Why, they'd tell me the things that they did when they were kids, the prayers they said, and the faith they had. And I said, you know what your problem is? It's not that you don't believe in God. You've lost your confidence in God. You've lost your trust in Him. And you've mistaken it. You believe in Him, but you're afraid of Him. But don't deny that He's there. Be realistic enough to say He's there, but I'm afraid of Him. And tell Him that you're afraid of Him. You've got to be honest above all with God Himself. And there's nothing that you can't tell Him. Now, when I stand before God and I meditate on Him, I see, first of all, being God, He's infinite in His perfection. He's all holy. He's all good. He's all just. Now, if I stand there and I see God as I misunderstand God, then I'm going to have an unfavorable reaction. And this unfortunately happens sometimes in AA. Here's a poor fellow that comes off Skid Row. He thinks he's an atheist. It's because he's afraid of God. And then when he does believe that there is a God, he says, look at me, a poor bum. Look at me, I've got nothing. Look what he's got. And he stands there and there's a misunderstanding. In other words, instead of being communication with God, there's a confrontation right away. There's a resistance, a rebellion. He's afraid. There's a feeling of discomfort. He doesn't want to run up to God. He wants to run away. He feels dirty. He feels ashamed. And so now instead of going to God, he wants to push away from God. And he will even do it to the extent many times that he will deny that that God is there. See that happen? That isn't an honest approach. We're supposed to be honest in every area of this program. Many times I've seen this as a reaction. A dishonest refusal to admit guilt that I'm wrong. There's two kinds of people you can run into. There's the immoral person and the amoral person. The immoral person has a conscience that's clicking. It knows when it's doing wrong. It doesn't try to hide it. It says, I'm doing wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway. It's not a question of not knowing. It's a question of not wanting to do the right thing, and it doesn't. But it knows it's wrong. But the all-moral person says, black is white. Conscience means with, con means with, science means knowledge. You start fooling around with that knowledge and you end up with what? Con. Start fooling with the knowledge of your conscience and you're a con man, not a conscientious person, you're a con man. Then there's a false pride that may come up. I think this is one of the things that makes it so hard for many people to admit they're alcoholics because there's such a moral stigma attached to this thing. They say, well, if I admit this, I admit that I'm a moral leper, which is completely wrong. So they say, I won't admit it. They may deep down in their hearts think, no, they are, but they're not going to admit it because they say, I will be admitting too much. I've seen this happen so often with poor women, the women of the program. I have all the admiration in the world for a woman who comes on this program. I think they're the greatest guys in the world. They've got guts, excuse the expression. But it's the kind of guts that saves. Then there can be the self-pity that comes in. Self-torment. Neurotic guilt. Over-guilt. You know, even in our guilt, we got to be honest. Suppose I steal a dollar. Well, if I'm honest, I should feel a dollar's worth of guilt, shouldn't I? I don't know how much that is today. We got any mathematicians here? Bankers? But suppose I steal a dollar and I feel $100 worth of guilt. Or suppose I just feel guilty. Sometimes people come to me and say, Father, I'm guilty. About what? I don't know. Geez, I don't know either. That's not honesty. That, in a way, is a very insidious form of spiritual phoniness. You gotta be even honest in your guilt. You're no more guilty than you are. You're no less guilty than you are. You are just exactly what you are. Then there's the other reaction. Why try? I'll fall again. I've seen that. Give up. You know, there's only one person that I've never been able to help in this program. It's the person who quits. The guy who will not try once more. I have had slippers that were like eels, slippery eels. They couldn't stand up straight for 5 minutes, but eventually they made it because they came back once more. And that was the time that God's grace, for some reason or other, took hold, and there they go. But the guy who quits, not even God can help that person. That's a form of despair, self-pity, which always ends up in some form of suicide, spiritual, mental, emotional, or moral. If there's one thing we should learn on this program is to never give up. Never give up on yourself, never give up on another person. Although I'll take that back with one reservation. In my own case, there was a person that I was trying to help for a period of 2 years. I don't think I ever put in more time on one person than that person. So one day after they had fallen again, I said to myself, that's it. I'm through. I don't know whether I'd have carried it out or not, but that was my determination at that time. You know what happened? The guy made it. When I got off his back, he made it. So I guess I must have been a big help, huh? But I tell you one thing, I didn't quit praying for the fellow. Those are some of the unfavorable reactions to this thing. Now, let's take the favorable ones. I'm standing here before God, person to person, and I contemplate him. He's my father. He's my all-good father. I should feel toward him not fear, but reverence. I reverence him. You know, you always feel reverence around a good person. You know, two of the greatest people in the world that I spend most of my time with are alcoholics and nuns, the sisters. I'm the confessor for about three groups of sisters, and I go out and give them talks. And as I say, I spend most of my time with alcoholics and nuns. In fact, I've got the nuns all praying for me under my alcoholic work. And when I go back, they want to know how did it go. And when I get some real tough guy, I get them praying for old Jim, and they'll want to know how's he doing. And we get him, okay, we keep praying. I got them praying for the Alkies. But you know, around Alkies, I feel a tremendous warmth and love for them. Around the good nuns, I feel a beautiful reverence. There's something about being around those good people that makes you feel reverential. Why, you wouldn't any more want to do anything irreverent around them than you'd cut your arm off. Because that's just the kind of a person they are, like Sister Ignatia. A reverence for goodness. Not only should I reverence God, but I should praise him. And I don't think there should be any trouble for any one of us in here tonight who's sober. If we would take a little inventory and say, who is responsible for my sobriety tonight? You know what I say? My heavenly sponsor. Well, my sponsor, I think, is in heaven. But I'm not talking about him. He's my earthly sponsor. My heavenly sponsor is God. I'm talking for him tonight and because of him tonight. Otherwise, I wouldn't be alive. And I think that is the same thing for each one of us. And for that reason, I thank him. I praise him because he's the only one that could save me. I had good people pray and do everything in the world to help me, and they couldn't help me. But he could. He did. And I praise him for it. I give him credit. He comes first in my book. But you know, sometimes I think we take God too much for granted. I think we do. I remember when I was a young seminarian studying for the priesthood down, it was right over here at Alma. He was one of our California boys, Yehudi Menuhin, the great violinist. Well, he used to live right next door to the Theologate over there, he and his little sister. And every spring, before he went out in his world concert, Yehudi used to come over to the Theologate and put on a two-hour concert for the theologians. We didn't have any nice auditorium. We used the dining room. We'd push the tables back. And Yehudi'd come in with his grand piano, and he was all dressed up in his formal suit with his accompanist, and then he'd put on this two-hour concert. Well, as great as he is, I'll be very frank that I'm not too appreciative of violin music. I had a sister who took violin. And I think I have developed a deep-seated resentment for it. But the thing that I used to marvel at was the way he manipulated his beautiful hands. I used to sit up close and watch him. He almost hypnotized me. And another thing that I used to marvel at, when he got through, he was completely covered with perspiration, like he'd been wrestling. And I remember his dad was his manager. And I remember one time after the concert, I asked his dad, I said, "Does Yehudi sweat that much at all these concerts? Does he put out that much energy?" He said, "No, Father." He said, "You may not believe this, but this is Yehudi's greatest concert." And I said, "You mean that?" He said, "Yeah, he wasn't getting a dime for it." And he says, "You know why? Because you young priests are so appreciative of his work." He says, "You know, this is one of the great problems of great artists. They're taking too much for granted. If Yehudi has a good night, well, he should have for $5 a seat, so not much is said. But let him hit a couple bad notes, they say Yehudi has quit practicing. He's not practicing enough, see?" Praise. I think in AA we can learn a lesson, too, to praise our other members of AA. You know, when a person gets up to talk, or when he tries to do something, when he puts the coffee out, to clean up the place, all these little things that so often are overlooked, a little word of appreciation and praise means an awful lot. I've known people that have had shown more courage and guts to get up and say just a few words in an AA meeting. And a few little words of congratulation would be just the thing they need to keep them going. I think we should be a little bit on the lavish side when it comes to praise. Not phoniness, but true appreciation. Thinking of the other guy. When I stand before God, I'm a sinful kneader. I should be humble. To be humble, does that mean that I got to be a doormat? I think sometimes when we come into AA, we get the idea you got to be humble. That means we got to stand out by the door there, and we got to let everybody wipe their feet on us as we come in. And you say, "I'm an alcoholic." That isn't humility. We're not asked to be doormats. All we're asked to be is truthful, honest, to accept ourselves as we are. There's a statement, if you want to make a success in this, take yourself as you find yourself and begin with that. Don't go any higher, don't go any lower. Right where you belong. Humility. And you know how we get humility? Humiliations. Humiliation. You know whether you heard the story about the good old pastor. And he had just come into this parish, and one of the good ladies was a very active member of the altar society. She was a right arm of the parish, and she used to do all the work around there. And anyway, she spotted this good new father coming in. She said, "Father, would you be my spiritual director?" And she says, "You know, I'm working on humility." And she said, "Would you try me?" She said, "I want to get humility." So the old father looked at her and said, "I wonder what the heck we got here." He says, "Okay, I'll take you on." Well, one day she came in with some work that she'd been doing for the good padre, some linens or something. So he started opening them up and looking at them very critically and throwing them around. And he turned to her and he says, "Lady," he says, "is this the kind of work you do for God's church? Take them away." Well, she hit the ceiling. She grabbed him up. She started out the rectory door. And just as she's going out the door, he said, Father, would you please try me? She spun around on her heels. She says, what'd you say? He says, Father, would you please try me? She says, were you trying me? He says, well, that's what you told me to do. And she says, well, why in the world didn't you tell me? You see, the humiliation that we know is coming, pretty sure, you know, 90% sure, we can get ready for it. We have an excuse and have it all worked out why we didn't win. But you know, when you've got it sure, you're going to win, it's going to go over, and it flops. Humble pie makes the humble person. When I stand before God, I want to make amends. You know, these amends steps are wonderful in the 12 steps. From step 4 to step 9, the amends steps. 7 of them. 7 out of 12. They must be pretty important things when you take 7 out of 12 and put them on the amends. In other words, amends must be a pretty big item on this program. And they are. And you know the first one I got to make amends to? God himself. He's the first. And actually, he's the easiest. All I have to do is tell him, well, I've bust this thing up pretty bad. I want to go into partnership with you now. I want to make this journey with you. I'm sorry for the things that I did because you've been so good to me all this time, and yet this is what I do to you. You're talking like a prodigal son. Sure, you're afraid of his just judgments, but you are sorry because you love him, because you feel that you've hurt him, and you tell him so. See, you've got to be honest with God. Use your own words. And you can do it without anybody listening in, anybody knowing you're doing it, you're doing it. And he'll say, I accept it. I accept it. It's all clear with me now. We're starting even on this journey. We're going to go together. We're all taken care of. What a wonderful way to start. What a tremendous burden has been released from you. You're free. You're free. I must look with God with confidence. He's not only all good, but he's all powerful. You can't beat that combination. I know lots of wonderful people that try to help me. God bless them. It wasn't a lack of love or desire. In fact, it was their prayers eventually that made it, their sacrifices that got me the grace. But they didn't have the power to do it. Who has? Over an alcoholic. So, you can't beat the combination of all goodness and all power. You got it in God. He's the only one. Thanksgiving. You know, this is getting close to Thanksgiving. Gratitude season. I don't know one virtue that embraces all other virtues more beautifully than gratitude. Show me a grateful person and I'll show you a humble person. You know, the proud person, there's no gratitude in the soul of a proud person. They expect you to do things for them. If you don't do it, they'll tell you off. But the humble person doesn't expect it, and they say, thank you. They're surprised. They're filled with awe that you do it. They're humble. They didn't expect it. They didn't feel worthy that you do it, but you did, so they're grateful. The grateful person is the happy person. True happiness, and that's what we're looking for in this program. We don't want to be a bunch of dry drunks. We want to be happy, sober and serene, happy. You know, when people come to me with their various problems, I get plenty of them. When I see in those problems self-pity, resentment, things that are going to destroy that person, you know what I tell them? You better get off of that. Fast. Or you're going to destroy yourself. And I've had many of them say, well, how am I going to do it? I'll tell you how you can do it. Start counting your blessings. If you want to get rid of your gripes, start counting your blessings. And the first one you can start with as an alky is, I am sober. I've got sobriety. And then you can start from there. You can go, the sky's the limit. Once you start with that. Petition. Ask, and you shall receive. You know, people say to me, well, why do we have to ask? Doesn't he know I need it? Sure he does. Well, he still wants you to ask. Well, why? I said, well, now, let's take this example. This may explain it. This is Christmas coming up now. This may be something that your kids are thinking about. Suppose that little Johnny wants a bicycle or a tricycle. And suppose the husband of the family says to his wife, now, I know Johnny wants a bicycle. I heard him talk to his little brothers and sisters. But he's not going to get it unless he asks me personally. That is the condition. Remember that. If he asks me, he gets it. If he doesn't ask me, I'm not going to buy it. Okay. So suppose now Mama Bear says, well, this may not be cheating a little, but I better tip him off. I better tell him about this little if, this little condition. So she says, Johnny, do you want a bicycle? Yeah, you better go ask your dad. You see? Now, did the fact that little Johnny comes to his dad and asks for the bicycle change his dad's mind in any way? No, it fulfilled a condition, didn't it? That's all it did. Does the fact that I ask God change him? No, it fulfills a condition. I will give him sobriety if he asks hard enough for it. But you got to ask. And you got to work for it. See? I think some people miss sobriety by one prayer. Somebody quit one prayer too soon. Thank God they didn't on my case. But I think some people do. They quit one prayer too soon. And they don't get their bicycle. Fidelity. You know, some people get the idea that be a great prayer. You got to be a guy that is so concentrated that you think of nothing else of God and spiritual things and that you go in kind of a trance. Well, I have not seen any sober people do that for a long while. I've seen a lot of alkies come along with spiritual experiences. At least they thought they were, and they wanted me to verify it. And I would say, well, I think, I hate to say this, but I think it was a case of delayed DTs. It kind of hurts their ego a little, but I think it's actually what it is. I say, you better watch yourself. In other words, to be a prayer doesn't mean that you have to go around constantly in concentration. You can do it 5-10 minutes a day, fine. But we can't do that all the time. What is the essence of prayer is faithfulness to prayer. Fidelity. Keep trying. Even though it doesn't seem to be going through. Even though I can't concentrate. Even though I'm distracted, keep trying. Fidelity. Don't give up. I remember one time when I was going to the dentist. To get some work done on my teeth. And I don't know. I have a little obsession about dentists or something. I don't know. Maybe it goes back to my childhood. I remember this dentist used to try to con me by stories and then pull a tooth. And I didn't like that. I guess that was my alky reaction. I didn't trust that guy. Because whenever he got nice, I knew that he was going to turn on something that would hurt. He's going to pull something that shouldn't come out. And I got a distrust for them. I hope there's no dentist here. But that's one of my obsessions. So when I go to a dentist now, I got to fight that childhood obsession, see? So when I go in there, I usually sit down and I start looking at those magazines that they have in there. I don't really know what I'm reading. And sometimes I'm surprised when I come back the third time and I said, I've seen this already. Okay. Well, anyway, I was doing that one day and an old gentleman came, sat beside me. And I noticed he was a little nervous. So I thought, well, maybe two nervous people get together here. We kind of straighten things out. So I broached a conversation about something. And the poor old guy thought he was going to go into a convulsion. And then we've kindly calmed him down, and I found out that he wasn't worried, nervous about the dentist. He was nervous because he was sitting next to me, a Catholic priest. This is before the days of Pope John. Well, anyway, I thought I'd better settle this old guy down. So we got talking about various things, and he was a wonderful old fellow. And the subject of prayer came up. And then he said to me, Father, and he was very serious, he says, you know, Father, I believe that God sent you here today to talk with me. And he was just as serious. He says, I believe this is divine providence at work. And I said, yeah, well, I said, why do you say that? Because he says, you know, I want to tell you something that I've been wanting to tell someone for a long time. And he says, now I've got the sign, I'm going to tell it. I said, what's coming here? He said, Father, I want to tell you something, and I want you to tell God this for me. See, I know he had great confidence in me as a priest, but I didn't know that I looked like a messenger boy. He says, I want you to tell God that I'm going to quit praying. And he was just as serious as a judge. And I said, what did you say? He says, I want you to tell God I'm going to quit praying. I said, Lord, what's going on here? And I said, why do you say that? He says, I'll tell you. He says, 40 years ago, I began to pray for a certain intention. And he told me what it was, and it was considerable. And he says, I can swear before you and God that I have never missed a day's prayer in 40 years praying for this intention. And I haven't got it. And he was resentful. So he says, I want you to tell God that I'm going to quit praying for that thing, and I'm going to quit praying, period. That was it. Gee, here I came in to get my teeth fixed. I forgot all about the dentist. I never had one like this thrown at me. And I was God's messenger. So I said, Lord, what am I going to do with this poor old gentleman? And you know, I had been reading just previous to that the statement that there's no such thing as an unanswered prayer. And all of a sudden, bingo, I got the answer. And I said to him, you know, it is providential that God sent me here today. And he looked at me and said, what's coming? He says, you know, I said, you know why? Because God wants me to tell you something. Well, he looked at me and he says, boy, I want, he must have a walkie-talkie. He never got an answer to a prayer as fast as that before. I said, God wants me to tell you that your prayer has been answered. And his face fell and he thought, my gosh, this guy's deaf. He didn't even hear me. And I said, you know why? I said, suppose that God had given you your answer to your petition, say a month after you started praying 40 years ago. Suppose he'd granted it. Could you be telling me today, 40 years later, that you had never missed a day's prayer? And you know, he looked at me and he says, I never thought of it in that light before. He says, probably I wouldn't have. And I says, most likely you wouldn't have. I said, do you realize that God, by saying no to you, gave you one of the greatest gifts he can give anybody, and that is the gift of fidelity in prayer. You have said a prayer every day for 40 years. Well, you know, when that seeped through, the old guy said to me, he said, Father, I got another message. He says, I want you to tell God that I'm going to continue to pray for that, and he says, I hope I never get it. Praying only for knowledge of his will. I've mentioned that in prayer we should ask. We should ask our good Father for our needs. Let him decide if they're the things that we need, but ask for them. But in this step, we ask for only two things. We don't ask to get our wife back. We don't ask to get our job back. We don't ask to get rich. We don't ask for anything but two things. For knowledge of his will, and the power to carry that out. Those are the only two things we ask for. You see why this is such a spiritual program? Knowledge of his will. Lord, what wilt thou have me do? Remember St. Paul when he got knocked off his horse? That event reminds me an awful lot of an Elkie. Here old St. Paul was on his horse, his high horse at that, full of resentment. He was going to get all these Christians. He was just hating them all. Going to beat hundreds, and all of a sudden, bingo. He hit the wall. Down he goes. And the first thing he asked, Lord, what wilt thou have me do? He saw the light. What wilt thou have me do? But that's only half of it. The other half and the bigger half is doing it. Doing it. I know Elkies that know what they're supposed to do, know that they're supposed to come on this program, but they're not doing it. They've only got half a grace. But for the grace of God, there go I. If I don't get both of them, there I am with them, outside. So when I pray for two things, the light to see and the strength to do. And believe you me, you will get it. You may not get a Cadillac if you ask for a Cadillac. You may not get money. You may not get this or that. But I'll guarantee you 100% that you get both these every time you ask for them. Light to see, strength to do. And the power to carry that out. I mentioned last night, I'll repeat this in our meeting last night, that how I try to do this. I like to make these steps an integral part of my daily life. Not just my AA life, my daily life, from the time I get up in the morning till I roll in the sack at night. I've got to have these principles. Because I'm only living a day at a time. Now when I get up in the morning, I make the third step. I turn my life and my will over to the care of God for that day. Okay. I want to know what His will is in this step. Lord, let me know what Thy will is and let me give me the strength to do it as I go along today. And you know, I make that in the morning just after I get up because that's the best time to make it. For me, it is. That's my low point. It should be my high point. But that's when I am at my stupidest. That's when I realize that we all have a little vegetable in us. Animal, vegetable, and mineral. And I've got to get my eyes focused so that I can shave and I won't cut this ear off about up here. And that's the time when if a bad day is coming up, if a lot of responsible things are coming up, that's when those old fears can come back to haunt me. Maybe this thing isn't going to work today. Maybe I'm not going to have success with this. Maybe this isn't going to... All those fears crowd in, and that's when I have to make this step and say, here, take it. That first hour. Till you get that first cup of coffee. That's the rough one. That's when you can make your greatest offering, as far as I can see. And that's when you need the greatest amount of courage. Right then. I even offer up my shave. I don't know what God trick he was pulling on me, but you see up here? No luck at all. Down here, 100-fold. And every morning... But I have to accept it, so I offer it up. They're just as hard to pull out whether you resent them or you accept them. And then in the evening, I like to check up and say, how'd you do today? It's actually not me checking up, it's he's checking up. We go over the books together. He's my partner. How'd you do today? Did you do your share of the work today? Did you do the footwork and leave the results to Him? Did you really try to turn your life and will over to Him the best of your ability? Did you try to surrender to His will? Or did you just comply to it? Did you do it not because you wanted to, but because you had to? Or did you do it not because you had to, but because you wanted to? You see? Why shouldn't we be happy even in this step? Why shouldn't we surrender and be happy in doing it? As they say, if you can't beat them, join them. I think every guy that walked in that door came in not because he wanted to, because he had to. I know I did. But I thank God I got to the point where I said, I have to, but I want to. And I enjoy it. It's more I want than I have to. These are a few ideas that I hope may be of some help to you. If they haven't been a help to you, they've been a help to me. Because as I started, I end. I was talking to Father Barney. If you'd all walked out on me, I could have said the same thing with the same zest to me. It's been a wonderful privilege to be here with you good people. As I say, whenever I come to an AA group, I feel I'm not amongst acquaintances, but friends. And I feel that I have made some wonderful, dear friends. And my trip here to Sacramento and all you good people, and I say, God bless you and keep up the good work.